Buenas tardes, good afternoon, hi everyone. I'm Edwin Mayorga in Educational Studies. And I have the pleasure of hosting or facilitating this panel discussion. The thing I will say, I don't have everyone's bios, so I'm actually going to ask if everyone could introduce themselves and just a quick word about it, because I also want us to zero in on the conversation in terms of time. It's also important for me to also recognize that we are building community and to also honor the land that this is native Lenni Lenape land that we are convening on. So that's also just part of my personal protocol. So I want to make sure that I say that as well. Could we start with Professor McGarrity on the end to just introduce yourself a little bit?
Martin McGarrity. I'm in the Department of Engineering. I teach environmental engineering. And I'm also have been involved with the Environmental Studies program since its inception here. Most of my work related to engaged scholarship with communities has been related to water and water issues, water pollution, water quality, locally in this vicinity, in this county, and more recently in Philadelphia, which is where I'm very much engaged right now. We'll have some things to say about that project as part of my recent connections with communities.
Hi, my name is Pallabhi Chakravarti. I teach in the Department of Music and Dance. I teach courses in dance anthropology, or what is called dance studies these days, as well as studio courses where I choreograph pieces for students. I'm engaged with scholarship in India, so most of my research work is in India. My courses are regularly cross-listed with religion, anthropology, gender and sexuality studies. I also have a dance company, which is community-based, and we do community work in India. So there's multiple connections in terms of how I work with performance.
I'm Betsy Bolton, and like Nelson, when I was asked to be on this panel, I thought, in what way am I a public scholar? And so I have three different possible answers. One is, as an English professor, a romanticist, I look at the ways in which, say, a Jane Austen novel is engaging. It's a very engaged text with the politics and the oppressive structures of the time. As an environmental studies, I've been able to chair the program in the past few years, and so in that context, I do a lot of looking at what Nelson was talking about in terms of the material conditions that impact how people are able to express agency. And I've also been able to be a part of the President's Sustainability Research Fellowship, which is definitely an engaged research exercise for arena for students. And then finally, I was able to go on a Fulbright fellowship to Morocco and work with community-based digital storytelling with a range of groups in Morocco several years back.
Hi, I'm Keith Reeves. I'm also an alum, and I'm chair of the Political Science Department here at Swarthmore. I teach courses mostly in the American politics realm and public policy. The two courses that I teach that have direct bearing on engaged public scholarship, one is an honor seminar on the urban underclass of public policy, in which we are primarily doing work mostly in Chester, but Philly and some other parts of the community across the country. And then the last course, it's a very popular course that I teach called Politics of Punishment, and that's the course that is taught in the Chester prison, in which I take 15, 12 more students, and we have class, as I would here on campus, with 15 incarcerated men, looking and examining issues around criminal justice policy. So I'll spend most of my time talking about that particular course.
Hi, I'm Lynn Sterling Schofield. I'm also an alum. Younger than Keith, but older than Nelson. I am in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics. Most of my community engaged work is through a community-based learning course I teach in data analysis, where my students work with community organizations who have data, but not necessarily individuals who can, say, analyze such data to answer questions that are of direct importance to those organizations to make them either more effective or more efficient in other kinds of ways. I'm going to be teaching again this fall, and I'm looking for a new org, so if any of you have friends in high places at various places, maybe see me afterwards, and we can chat.
All right. Well, welcome, illustrious panel. So I wanted to just dig in and start with thinking about how you personally define public or engaged scholarship, both in your work and in response to just the your particular field. We'll maybe open it up, but I was thinking maybe Professor Chakravarti, maybe you'd like to kick us off?
Sure, thank you. So yes, this is a very loaded question for me because I always struggle with this. So one of the things that I would like to emphasize is that I am involved with performance or dance, and it's not part of the linguistic realm. Usually in academia, we talk about politics, we talk about language, but I am working with nonverbal communication, and it's very important, I think, and we tend to ignore or marginalize those aspects of communication. So in my work, I engage with this aspect in multiple ways. First of all, I'm trained as an anthropologist. I do ethnography. So most of my ethnography is among dancers in India. My first project was on a dance style called Kathak. It's a classical Indian dance style, which I also practice. And my second project, which I just finished, was on dance television reality shows. So mostly when you think about dance music, it's part of the entertainment realm, or it's not something that is, you know, taken seriously in terms of the realm of politics, but at the same time, it's key, really. It's very important to understand how we engage with music and dance, and because music and dance and theater and all the aspects of performing arts, it's completely related to identity, cultural identity, and it's related to discourses, or dominant discourses, or hegemony. I mean, there's a lot there in terms of national identity, community identity. So my first project, really, because I was a practitioner and I had normalized many aspects of my identity, that when I went to actually dig further, you sort of work like an archaeologist to some extent, I understood some of the forced, forgotten history of India. I mean, this is not what I was trying to find. In terms of the Islamic influences, because the dance comes from, I'll just give you a really, in a nutshell, the Kathak style, the dance itself comes from the Mughal courts, but it's basically in the larger narrative, it has been Hinduized. I'm not going to go into all of the nuances of that. But so basically what I was able to do is interrogate how certain discourses are constructed and how it becomes part of our common sense. And so I could actually, through my research, talk about an alternative history where I saw that a particular group of women who were called the Tawaifs, or Muslim courtesan women, who had completely been marginalized and stigmatized as prostitutes. So all of this was kind of heart-wrenching, and it's part of the post-colonial scholarship and subaltern history, which I could connect my work to. And then I looked at the democratization of the form and looking at women's identities and so forth. So that was my first project. And as you can see, that was very much, you know, part of this particular post-colonial scholarly discourse that was emerging from India's subaltern history and so forth. But on the other hand, what I was also engaging with at the same time was emotion, because I could not engage with how people were feeling. Because I'm a practitioner, I know why we get attracted to the realm of music, dance, and performance. It's about feeling states, basically. So I kind of in the process became also a scholar of emotion. Although I was very much trained in political economy, I just could not leave aesthetics behind. And so I founded a company, it's called Courtyard Dancers Here, to actually sort of work with these other aspects of our identity, that why it drew a lot of people together, and we were making choreographic work. That I feel that most of what I do nowadays, and I'm using the term feel because I think, and I think we are all thinking and feeling at the same time, that it's important to cultivate our emotion, and that this cultivation of sentiment or emotion, it's not that I'm a pioneer in talking about it, other people have talked about it in many different ways, that the performance, that it's such an important aspect of performance, or how we express ourselves. And I think that going back to Engage Scholarship on this campus, that we have, the music and dance department, it's a theory practice department. So we teach our students how to engage in multiple ways, so how to cultivate your emotion in the studio spaces, because dancing or music is about expressing emotion, and how you can connect that to larger discourses of politics and aesthetics. So this has been my Engaged Scholarship, and from there, some of the questions that was raised by the first speaker, Nelson, that in terms of because I also am, I'm a bilingual, multilingual. I grew up in a different country. Just to do ethnography and sort of perpetuate my own career, I mean, that's not how I have engaged with my work, and I struggle with that also. So I with this community that I work with, the Courtyard Dancers, we started sponsoring classes in an underserved area in Calcutta. And that has also grown. And I want to emphasize this fact because when all, I also publish regularly because I know that it's very important to keep, for us, for people, I mean, there's so many kinds of marginalization, right? Music and dance is not, dance especially struggles within the academia. I'm not going to go into the long sort of history of that. So you always have to legitimize yourself as a scholar that, oh yeah, I can do this. So this is part of, I feel, as dance scholars, and dance studies is a very new field that we have to produce. We have to make that foundation so that other people can contribute in the future. So that's part of what we are doing. At the same time, this particular, thing that we've started doing with my company, it's also important because then we can give something back to that community, because most of the people I'm working with here who are maybe South Asians or from the from that area, geographical area, they are STEM people. They so sort of to work with people who are positioned differently within a particular community, and how to make them also to some extent aware of their own privilege, because not everybody's thinking in these terms. This has been a very important learning experience. And I think that I try to communicate some of these struggles to my students as well.
All right, thank you. Anyone else wanna take a stab at that first question? Or I can just pick. Lynn, do you have any thoughts? Or?
So, I guess I people that know me in some sense as a statistician, I've said before, I think almost all statistics in some ways is engaged scholarship. I mean, in many ways, I've sort of said that I think statistics is the most interdisciplinary discipline that exists. Right, so you need statistics essentially in any of the natural sciences and all of the social sciences. Certainly the humanities are more and more, as they move into digital humanity work, are seeing that the need for statisticians, the need for computer scientists, the need for data analysts. And so there's a way in which sort of all work by statisticians, you could argue, is sort of somewhat public scholarship. I think when I describe the difference between mathematics as a discipline and statistics as a discipline, what I often say is we look at questions in different ways, right? So statisticians sort of start with what the question is, start with what data it is that we need to analyze, and then go from there. And that sometimes means that we need to use mathematical theory or probabilistic theory. Whereas I think of mathematicians in some sense as more asking an interesting research question that will sometimes get applied. I think we need both sets of research, right? So I think it's very clear that not everyone can necessarily always only be doing engaged scholarship. You need the mathematicians who are going to come up with some theory that we won't realize we're going to need for 50 years, and we've seen that happen over and over and over again, that kind of work happens. For me, a big part of the reason I teach the class that I do is that the way a lot of statistics, especially at the undergraduate and even now at the K-12 level, is taught are these sort of canned, rote methods, if you will. And I think most of us who are statisticians would argue that almost all of the work that really influences the kind of biases that come in and the kind of conclusions that one can draw is the way in which data is collected, the way in which researchers have gathered that data and what they think of it, and that those kinds of influences on the data matter far more than what regression you run or a t-test or whatever other work that you do. So part of what I really wanted to do was sort of twofold. One, I wanted my students to understand what real data looks like, that it's really ugly and it's really messy, and even the best organizations who are doing the best job they can only get such pretty data. And I remember at the end of my class, I had thought I had done this great job of finding organizations that were really in good shape, and one of my students wrote in the evaluation, "Next time you should find organizations that have better data." And I thought, well, the point was you were supposed to recognize that's kind of not out there. It's not all this pretty data that exists in textbooks and other places. But the other thing for me that that I found very frustrating is that I remember when Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times columnist, came here to Swarthmore, and he gave us a talk, and I sort of begged and pleaded to be part of the dinner conversation that we have, because I've really enjoyed most of his columns over the years. But at one point, a student at the end of his talk got up and said, "You know, I'm a physics major, I think, or I'm a chemistry major. I don't remember our particular science they were. You know, what can I do to sort of be a part of these inequalities that exist?" And his response was kind of like, "Well, you should just quit your physics work for a while and go to some country and do some volunteer work." And I found that, as a scientist, such an offensive remark. And so part of my work is also, I think, to show especially my mathematics and statistics students that there's a role for them. It might not be on the ground, you know, at necessarily the organization that they're working in, but there are behind-the-scenes jobs that are really important for those of us that understand data or understand other things that we can do to help some of the people that are on the ground. But that much of that work has to be done in building the relationships among those groups, both between those of us who are academics and who understand that kind of expertise, working with those who are on the ground with their kind of expertise and understanding the way that those two-way streets work.
Okay, so the question about how to define public scholarship, and so I'm going to talk about how I sort of stumbled into it by getting involved in the 90s in monitoring local water quality, getting my students out in the Crum watershed and local. There's three different streams that flow here, the Chester Creek, the Ridley Creek, and the Crum Creek, and there's a Watersheds Association. I'm getting connected with that. And so we began to characterize problems with water quality in streams. And then I wanted to get more into exploring solutions to the problem, as engineers like to do. So I got into modeling. We use modeling of physical systems to explore new possibilities. So the first thing to do is to sort of look for the reasons for the problems, so we know where to direct solutions. And so I started doing modeling, and I was looking for data to put into the models. And there are many sources that you can just sit in your office and bring them in online and start running your models. So I started running my models locally, and I see that one thing that we have to model is landscape, all right, what's on the landscape. Because the problem around here, and all really cutting-edge problems in water quality, relate to runoff of stormwater into streams, picking up all the different things that society that modern technology leaves behind it and flushing it into the streams. It causes problems. So I look at the data that I bring in over the internet, and it says there's cornfields just north of Swarthmore. Well, I didn't remember there being any cornfields, so I have to jump in my car and I look for these cornfields, and it's actually Springfield Golf Course. Right. So the data is, I have to go out and to the community to sort of touch base with reality. Another thing I did was model the flow in the stream, and we also measured the flow in the stream. So we go out and monitor it and measure it with my students. And there's a big discrepancy between what the model shows and what actually we measure. So again, I have to get in my car, and I find there's this big catch basin that didn't show up in the data because it was all covered with trees, and it was changing the reality. You have to go out and find it. So that's how I started, you know, needing to go out and connect somehow, and that led to then, as we got into solutions, it means doing something to the landscape, doing something to where people live. And so there are methods. These days we're calling it green infrastructure that you can put in place to make the land more like a sponge, like it was when William Penn showed up with all the forest we had. You can sort of make the landscape like that. But to do that, you have to make changes where people live in their communities, and there's policy implications of that. And so there was a need to proceed with this research to connect with the people, connect with the institutions, the environmental advisory councils in the various townships, the Watersheds Association. And another thing I do is look for what's best. You can look at what if I try this with simulation models, but then also you need to look for among all the different possibilities and look for the one that maximizes the benefits in water quality, but also accounts for the benefits locally in the neighborhoods where these various technologies are installed. So that required the kind of information that you can't get from online databases. You have to connect with the people in the communities. And so I'll say more about this if I get a chance, but that's sort of what has driven me into this, the need to engage the communities, to talk about the people's aspirations in the neighborhoods where technology will be installed. What impact is this going to have on them? Do they want it? Will it serve their needs as well as the needs of the streams and rivers into which this runoff is going to flow? That's going to be crucial in the success of any of these enterprises. And how can we find, you know, win-win solutions? And that has fundamentally changed the way fundamentally influenced the way I theorize mathematically about these various forms of models that might be used to solve the problem. And it turns out you can't have a model that just brings in databases off the internet or even the library or wherever. You've got to engage the community where you're working, find out what's important to them. Otherwise, otherwise you produce a report, a paper that is read by a few people, it sits on a shelf, and nothing ever happens with it. That's how sort of how I define public scholarship and how I get into it.
Okay. So I came to public scholarship because of my lived experience, believe it or not. I grew up in Chester, late 60s, early 70s. And for me, the inequality piece was front and center. And I knew as a kid, even as a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old, that the politics and policy pieces were what, in my view, were driving the inequality. So that led me to pursue political science, led me to pursue public policy. And so in many instances, I couldn't get away from the public scholarship pieces because for me, even in here at Swarthmore and in grad school, I was always asking the question, what's the connection to improving the political and the policy situation in Chester and communities like it? And so a lot of my earlier work was really in the area of politics and inequality, voting rights, which is what I was mostly known for nationally. And then I came back to Swarthmore at the college's invitation in 99, and I was starting to work on a book on formerly incarcerated individuals, giving them back the right to vote. And I had a neighbor who said to me, oh, you should go down to the prison. And I'm like, what are you talking about? There's no prison. I grew up here. And I was astounded to find that there was a medium security prison in the community on the former site of Sunship Parcel. And I was just astounded. And for 2 years, I ignored it. And much like Art, I got an invitation to go into the prison, which I ignored and finally went in. And it changed my personal and my professional life, in part because I found on the second floor, the prison library, a former neighbor of mine who was doing a life sentence. And that started me sort of on a personal and political intellectual journey to try to figure out why this community that had produced lots of amazing, amazing people was sending so many men off to prison. And so I started totally reorienting my questions and my research and making sure that I was a political scientist who actually went out and did field work. even though I had been trained quantitatively at the University of Michigan in very important work, but I was starting to figure out I had to get back into the community space and do field work. And as Nelson said earlier, that is enormously painstaking, it's arduous, it's time consuming, but I spent 7 or 8 years just quietly going into prisons, meeting with men, talking with them, connecting with their families, getting sort of ethnographic work done, talking to policy people and so forth. And then a few years after that, Swarthmore students found out that I was doing this work and they asked if I would take them into the prison for a course. They'd found this wonderful model at Temple called the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program. And I said, no. And much like Swarthmore students, they came back and said, but we really, really need you to do this. This would be great for us. And I said, no, again. And much like Swarthmore students also, don't give up. So they contacted the director of the program and invited her to lunch and said, Reeve, she's coming to lunch on Friday. It would be really, really rude of you not to show up. True story. And I showed up, I did the training and so forth. And that's how the Politics of Punishment course was born. It was not born of my initiative. It was really Swarthmore students who pushed me in that space. And so every year in the spring, I take 15 Swarthmore students down. We choose 15 inside classmates, we call them. And we have a pedagogical seminar in a circle. I am just the facilitator. And we have an entire intense seminar on criminal justice policy issues. So for me, what's significant and what's important is the affected community, or the affected public, as Nelson would call it, actually is engaged in the nature of the work. So it's not simply that, as Bard has a wonderful model, in which Bard professors go in and they teach incarcerated men. Students at Bard serve as tutors. We have a different model. I like their model, they like our model, in which actually students are peer-to-peer learners and co-collaborators of the work. But we are very intentional, and I'm very intentional, and including the incarcerated men in the nature of the work. What also turns out to be transformative is the work that we do. Each of the guys who is with us is on a housing unit that houses 60 other men. So they immediately leave our class and they go back to their housing units and so on. And they are reteaching, if you will, across the entire prison space. This is a prison that has about 1,200 men, medium security prison. They are reteaching men across the entire correctional facility, much of what they learned in class with their Swarthmore peers. And what's also quite interesting and unexpected is the correctional officers, the staff, the superintendent's office and so forth are also reading and learning alongside with us, because the class is producing and pushing all kinds of questions, all kinds of conversations, inside the prison that were not there had we not been coming in to do our course. So the connection with community ends up being really important. Those of you who've been following the horrible tragedy out of Delaware where the correctional officer there was killed, one of the men apparently talking with the negotiator says, we want education. That is essentially an important piece of why we do what we do. The men who we work with and who learn with us are incredible. They are probably more prepared than we are. But the kinds of knowledge that is created as a result of that experience is really quite remarkable. Then the last piece that I'll add is my class is very specific in terms of coming up with group policy projects. So toward the end, the last third of the course, the inside students and the sophomore students work on collaborative policy projects, and those ideas then get fed back into the system, if you will. So the governor, the Secretary of Corrections, the prison staff, legislators both in Harrisburg and Washington get those ideas as a means and a way of trying to really impact reform and impact policy and practices that hopefully will make life better. And the reason why this is so significant is 93% of the men whom I work with will return back to the community. And so for me, at least on a personal, intellectual, professional level, it is really, really incumbent and significant and important that we do something with them while they are incarcerated so that they are better citizens when they return back home to the community space.
Thanks, Keith. Betsy, did you have some thoughts?
So, illustrious panel indeed. I find myself wanting to make myself sound as good as all my co-panelists, but I think I'm going to resist that tendency because if our goal is actually to make it possible for more people to do this, I want to speak from a more newbie perspective and sort of say some of the things that are helpful, I think, to somebody who's on the steep growth edge of the curve. And so So I wanted to start by thanking you, Edwin, for your invocation and naming of the land and recognition that this is Lenni Lenape land, and to touch back to Nelson saying we need to recognize the oppressive history of academia as well. And one book that has been really helpful for me in recognizing that is Ebony and Ivy, looking at settler colonialism and the embeddedness of the university system in this country in that process. That was one paragraph, I guess, in my head. I want to speak I feel as though art has spoken for the environmental studies side really beautifully, so I'm going to ditch that hat for a moment. And I will speak from an English professor side and briefly from a Fulbright scholarship side. As an English professor, it's very vivid to me that we had a retreat in January 2015, maybe, and we were talking about engaged scholarship, and Nora Johnson, who was then the chair, wrapped up that conversation by saying, so we all agree, all good scholarship is engaged scholarship. It's the engagement that gives our work legs and gives our work life and helps it make meaning in the lives of the students that we work with, our academic public, and any other public we can reach out to. So here I am, I'm a white girl. I teach a class on Jane Austen, who's like a dead white girl. And it's chick lit, right? It's bathtub reading. It's like they used to give Jane Austen novels to soldiers to in World War I, help them get over nerve gas because there was nothing threatening in that book. So how could that be engaged scholarship, right? So when Nelson was talking, I was also thinking about linguistic analysis. And so if you actually look at the language in a Jane Austen novel, you can trace back and find out that she's referencing and quoting Mary Wollstonecraft, who is sometimes known as the mother of feminism. We'd call her pretty radical right now. And if you look at the arguments that Austen seems to be citing, some of those arguments are arguments Mary Wollstonecraft was having with Edmund Burke, who is the father of American conservatism from one perspective. So we got a mother and a dad, don't get on very well. And in particular, I hope nobody minds, I'm spoiler alert, Pride and Prejudice, if you don't know this story, plug your ears. But in Pride and Prejudice, we've got Edmund Burke talking about trying to defend the Ancien Régime against the French Revolution. And he says, you know, we have lost the sensibility of principle, and it goes on for a while, under which vice itself lost half its evil by losing all of its grossness. So that's in Reflections on the Revolution of France. Mary Wollstonecraft says, no. The only thing that we get, there could be nothing worse than billeting a group of soldiers in a small country town whose ornamental gallantry, both their uniforms and their behavior, their polished manners render vice more dangerous by concealing its deformity under gay ornamental drapery. So do manners and good dress get rid of evil by making vice less gross? Or do they make it worse? Jane Austen takes that and turns it into a novel. She gets a bunch of soldiers and puts them in a small town and says, is that detrimental to the morals of the inhabitants, the way Mary Wollstonecraft said? Or does it actually make it all just fine? And the answer is not so simple. In the case of Lizzie Bennet, her morals are just fine, thank you. In the case of her younger sister, Lydia, her life is potentially destroyed by the deception under that gay ornamental drapery. Mm-hmm. So part of what she's doing is asking whose job is it to look out for somebody like a Lydia Bennet? And I don't think it's an accident that the rich guy in this story makes enough money in 1 year to pay off Lydia's seducer and get her safely married. The people with the money are responsible for looking out for the people who are less able to do it. So that's a piece that I'm thinking about and working on, and what's my public for that, right? Mm-hmm. Where do I put that? I'm not so sure, but I think it may be useful for those of us in the academy to think as broadly as possible about what counts as engaged scholarship. And then on the Fulbright front of things, I just want to go back to something Nelson said about humility and who gets to be a public scholar. So I had the great privilege of going to Morocco as a Fulbright fellow, and what I discovered as I landed was that every Moroccan is an educator, and they all had something, and they very explicitly so. So person after person was like, the one thing I want you to learn, the one thing I want you to understand and take back to your country is, and it was in general about community and about values. And so it would be the person helping us find a place to live who was like, you need to understand in your country the importance of family and the importance of staying together. Serving your elders, and I learned so much from that. I think it's really important in engaged scholarship to have a beginner's mind, and to be open to that kind of learning. My last project in Morocco was working with traditional artisans in the Fez Medina, which is like a medieval city of Islam in kind of the center of Morocco. And those guys were amazing. They were so steeped in tradition and religion, spirituality, cultural practices, and they were such eloquent storytellers. And so it was just this incredible privilege to be in their presence and to learn from them. What then is my responsibility, I think Nelson would ask me, about public representation of that work? And what I chose to do was put their stories up on a blog to try to be, I asked them to make their own stories, and they said, we are masters of our craft. You are master of the iPod. You tell the story. But to put it up without any structure, without trying to frame it. And I don't know whether that was the right thing to do or not. Imagining America is a national conference which has been super inspiring and helpful to me in trying to think about issues of public scholarship, and a group associated, and Joy Charlton took me there, paid for me to go there a few years ago, and I continue to go back. And the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture is a group associated with that conference, which I really love. It is not a federal agency, so they can't cut its funding. So it will continue to go on. So if anybody wants to participate in a story circle associated with that USDAC in the next week, please let me know.
See y'all.
Yeah,
makes me glad to be working here. I did want to leave a little time for questions, but I would be remiss to not also get at this other question that I would love, you don't all have to answer it, but I would love to hear maybe two or three thoughts on this. And that's really, what's clear is, part of the mission of this convening is to actually develop a working definition of engaged in public scholarship, and it's clearly multifaceted, right? And it's, one that's, a full-bodied experience, I think, as scholars, and trying to navigate the contradictions, having, beginner perspectives, having these different demands that are placed upon us. And, the first thing that I think about is, is it really worth all that work? I don't know. I do think it is. The question I'm wondering and thinking about is, do you all feel as though the kind of work that you're doing and engaged in is valued by our college in particular, but higher education in general? And specifically, I'm thinking about, one of the elephants in the room, I think, is tenure, right? And I think Nelson very nicely started to lay that question out in terms of, how do we count these things? So I guess it's kind of, I'm squeaking in two questions here, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it. One, how is it valued here? And two, do you feel as though it should count for tenure, and for, protections in terms of the work, to protect the work that you're doing so that you can continue to do it? What do you think?
I would say yes and yes. That is, it is valued, I believe. And should be valued in terms of tenure. We're able to, and certainly we've been moving much closer and better in the direction and toward engaged scholarship in the last couple of years or so. I would argue we've been able in political science to actually attract a really amazing applicant pool, but also been able to attract great folks in the department, in part because we have been able to kind of champion and put out to applicants at the college is really, really taking on this quite seriously. We also are part of, not simply political science, but other departments, are part of a larger conversation across the college about what each department's criteria are for tenure and promotion. And so inside the department, we're having an active conversation about this part of the portfolio, not simply for tenure, but also for promotion. And my sense is that we have a consensus that this ought to count. To Nelson's point, we haven't quantified it, but there's a general kind of sense that this really is invaluable work. It's invaluable for us as scholars, as teachers, certainly for our students, and we are actively inside the department encouraging the direction of moving more in this space.
In the sciences, there are more difficulties. The fact that the two of us here from that division, maybe it's a little more natural for us to need to connect because of what we do, I think indicates that there's some challenges for those in the sciences that do work that don't so readily lend themselves to connection because maybe there's less of a need to be successful to connect. I think discussion in the sciences along the lines of what Betsy's talking about ways to get sort of newbies into this to
to think more broadly about what engagement means, better definitions of it will be helpful, and help facilitating that process, whatever way possible, to find a way to facilitate that process. It's going to be necessary for successful integration of engaged scholarship into the tenure evaluation process.
Mm-hmm. I think it is supported definitely at Swarthmore, and I really am happy to say that we do support choreographers or artists here. At the same time, I want to highlight the fact that oftentimes we have to justify. I mean, it's always that, you know, there's a kind of justification that it has to be connected to social justice or something which is very prominent out there, but many times, you know, things are not so obvious and you have to look beyond the political linguistic world. I mean, everything is political as far as I'm concerned, but the linguistic world of politics, you have to look beyond that to see how it works as something that is transformative. And on the other hand, I would also like to talk about labor, because I've been thinking about that, especially because I work as an artist scholar, and very much as an artist scholar, I'm involved with the production side of things. And we, although in academia, we are quite aware of the intellectual labor. I mean, we think about that as labor, but just in terms of maybe some of our faculty members, I don't know how much people are aware of what goes into creating an art piece is one thing, but producing is something else, because now art works within a particular kind of industrial complex, and we are all part of it. I can say I want to be a choreographer, but that means I have to work with a sound designer, a costume designer, you know, lighting designer. All of these people, they need to be coordinated, so there's a lot of labor that is hidden. Mm-hmm. And the more I see this, and I see the people that I'm working with, and they feel marginalized, they feel frustrated because they are not up here talking about their labor. So I would like to sort of highlight the fact that how do we think about labor, and what does that mean in terms of engaged scholarship?
I think that one other, to piggyback on that, and sort of to go back to Nelson's comment of sort of saying that his bilingualism has been more appreciated the more degrees he's received. And in some ways, I feel like my engaged scholarship has been more appreciated the more successful it's been. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that needs to be sort of mentioned and made aware, right, is at least in the work that I do, right, as I've just said, the data's really messy and it's ugly and it's not what we would like it to be. And so there aren't easy solutions, and many of those, it's a risk in many ways to do this kind of work. And while in some cases I have managed to be successful in that, there are other cases where, you know, it's failed spectacularly. And certainly that's always true in any research and any teaching that one does. But the more that you're willing to take risks to do that, the more likely those risks are going to lead both to great successes, but also to great failures. And I'm not sure, while I believe Swarthmore greatly supports it, certainly there's institutions like the Lang Center and the Dean's Office and others who really work to make this work supported. I don't know how well we've yet managed to put into place structures that allow for failures to happen, and a recognition that sometimes the most learning we can do is from those failures.
That's a very good point.
Thank you all for participating.